Welcome back to In Search of Tarot, a podcast that examines, questions, and reimagines our approach to life and the cards.
Through guest interviews and in-depth discussions, we'll explore and expand the beautiful complexities of spirituality, philosophy, magic, and more.
I'm Nick.
And I'm Angie.
And we're your hosts for this fascinating ride.
Thanks for being here with us.
Our guest today is Sophie Strand, a writer based in the Hudson Valley who focuses on the intersection of spirituality, storytelling, and ecology. Her first book of essays, The Flowering Wand, Rewilding the Sacred Masculine, will be published by Inner Traditions in November of this year and is currently available for pre-order. Her eco-feminist historical fiction reimagining of the Gospels, The Madonna Secret, will also be published by Inner Traditions in spring of 2023. Subscribe for her newsletter at sophiestrand.substack.com and follow her work on Instagram at cosmogony and at sophiestrand.com. Sophie is the last of our return guests for this season, and I'm so excited for you to listen to this interview with her. And next week, we will kick off an entirely new string of wonderful guests. So stay tuned and enjoy this episode. Sophie, welcome back to In Search of Tarot.
Thank you so much for having me, Nick. It's, as we were saying before we started to record, it's a nice punctuation in the midst of a lot of very incoherent and interesting happenings.
Yeah. It's been like a little over a year, we were saying, and yet it feels like so much time has passed because so much has happened. But I'm truly like, I'm so happy to see you, like just seeing you pop on the screen this morning, because I always love talking to you, you know, and you bring so many great thoughts into the world. So I'm super excited to chat with you today. We're going to talk about a new book that you have coming out, which is now called The Flowering Wand, Rewilding the Sacred Masculine. But will you say the original title? Because I just love it so much.
Thank you. Yeah. The title that I actually chose. Lunar Kings, Lichenized Lovers, Rhizomatic Harpists, and Trans Species Magicians Heal the Masculine. That was my original, less anthropocentric, less, you know, bioessentialist title.
Yes. So we're lifting that up. But that comes out on November 22nd by Inner Traditions. Yeah. And is available now for pre-order. And then you also have an Advaya 8-week course that's launching, that's also called Rewilding Mythology. That kicks off November 7th and runs through December 19th. So we'll kind of touch on both of those things in this conversation. But if anyone that's listening missed my original conversation with you last year, I really encourage you to go back and listen to that. We're going to kind of dive in and move forward from there. So we won't spend too much time today kind of talking about your background as much, which is what we talked about last time. We'll kind of move forward into where we are now. So to help us do that, will you just kind of root us where you are right now in your present moment by sharing, you know, a little about who you are today, which I think is something I actually did ask you last time, and where you are in the world.
Thank you, Nick. I am a writer interested in the intersection between spirituality, ecology, and storytelling. I live on the land of the Munsee Lenape people, the land of the black bear and the mountain lion and the honey fungi. I also live in land that has known extraordinary genocidal violence and that slipped out of the history books. Very particularly, I live on the land where the Esopus Wars happened. And I've been in the past month been really trying to go back and find primary documents that can help me understand how the Dutch came in and killed everybody. So yeah, that's a little bit of a stitching me into place. So I'm really interested in where ecology and storytelling meet, and where a rigorous scholarship can also be composted with creativity and poetry.
Beautiful. So, you know, in talking about this book today, which I'm so excited to dive into it, it feels like maybe the most, you know, obvious place to start is asking you what you mean when you talk about masculine. You know, what does that mean to you? And why did you choose to write a book about it?
Well, first I'll say I didn't really order this off the menu. I never thought I would write a book like this. I've been thinking about this question because, you know, I wrote this book 3 years ago, and a lot of my ideas about gender, about storytelling, about identity have changed radically on a personal level and also kind of in a more relational sociopolitical way. But I would say that I think that masculinity is a Eurocentric colonial project. You know, one half of a value dualism that posits certain behaviors and bodies as normative and most others as deviant. And so, it's a colonial tool. I mean, masculinity doesn't exist. I don't believe anything is born masculine or feminine, but then again, neither does money. And yet it still does work. It still decides who lives and who dies and who is given a podium and who is not. You know, there's an incredible experimental theologian, Mary Jane Rubenstein, who says it's not useful to say God is dead if God is still operating. And what she means is if this idea is still operating inside the culture and a lot of people still believe it exists and still let it determine their actions, we can't say it's over. And so I think for me, I've known violence at the hand of people who identify as male and institutions that are, you know, patriarchal and masculine. And I was very averse to them. I didn't want to have anything to do with them for a really long time. And I think that under the cover of COVID, in that chrysalis, and with a lot of time alone in my own life, I thought, I have to heal this. I have to understand this. And I've been very interested in, you know, the rise of monotheism, the rise of civilization, what goes wrong, how do we become such a ecologically insane species. How do we think that this type of living is possible and sustainable? And so paired with that historical anthropological research, I began to think that, you know, masculine has become conflated with patriarchy, but it's meant many different things in different cultures. Not that it has, you know, is a real thing that you know, is born and exists, but that it has occurred again and again as a term and as an idea, but it has meant different things. And perhaps the ways it was articulated before the rise of empire and certain types of like Platonistic dualisms was healthier.
Yeah.
So kind of convoluted answer. Mostly it's like you just said, how would you define masculinity? I think definitions in and of themselves are a kind of academic in post-Enlightenment era operation where you want to try and pin the butterfly to the page so that you can study it. But the truth is you kill it when you pin it down. When you define something, you pretend as if you can own it and you can keep it stable. But the truth is that, you know, identity should always be moving. Our bodies only look the same because they're constantly taking in new matter, digesting and expelling. And I think identity should be similar, you know, be it anything along the rhizomatic continuity of the many different genders that are available in other cultures. And you should be allowed to travel along that rhizome and be different every day. And in fact, letting yourself be changed is what keeps your body alive.
Yeah, well, that leads me to my next question, which was, you know, something that I've learned from you and hear you talk about a lot is the location of stories, or, you know, the importance of placing ideas, you know, where they were originally born. So how did that inform the way that you approached writing this book? You know, certainly agree that there is no such thing as like a tangible masculinity, but also on top of that is every society, every time and place has had their own ideas about this. So, you know, how did you think through that as you were writing this book?
Well, I think that stories and paradigms can easily lapse into dogma when they're uprooted from their relational context. And every being is contextual. You know, you take the breath out of a room and I'm gonna die. You know, I'm not just an individual, I'm a concatenation of oxygen and relationality. And the same is true for ideas. Ideas arrive through beings in certain places, expressing a dialogue with a specific place. And so as I was looking at mythic figures who've become kind of patriarchal figureheads like Jesus, like white daddy Jesus, and also figures like Perseus and Theseus, and you know, who wield the sword and kill the dragons. If we put them back in their context, in their web of relationality, what do we see that was missing before? How do they become more nuanced and complex figures? Is there more there that's been pushed underneath the kind of concrete of a very simplistic colonial interpretation?
Mm-hmm. Do you, you know, just to bring it back to tarot, since this is a tarot show, do you ever think about this in relation to tarot? Do you ever think about how has tarot been uprooted and
what? Oh my God, yeah. I mean, I think tarot is actually an incredible tool in that it's slippery. You cannot pin it down. We cannot tell exactly where all of these different things came from. It's inherently mycelial, and that there are like 1,000 different branching tips, and it's hard to know where the original spore landed. And I think one of the issues with tarot is the mythology, the deracinated mythology attached to it, which is this idea that it was some kind of like esoteric, hermetic, Kabbalistic thing that actually a white, you know, non-Jew created. Mm-hmm. And I think that you've done an incredible job of demystifying the mythic paint jobs that have been put over it. I think for me, what I love about tarot is that it's incomprehensible. It's impossible to completely root it back in its origin. And I think there's this very Darwinian linear impulse for us to go back to the original, to find the original ancestor, to find the original human, like to put a stake in the ocean of evolution and say, like, that was the last monkey, that was the first human, to go back and say, like, that was the first tarot deck, that's where it came from. And I think that impulse is trying to put order onto entangled ecosystems that inherently resist order and in fact are resilient in that they are always confounding normal ideas of coherence.
Yeah, it's just making me think about the way that I've been thinking about gender recently, which is that, you know, divining gender as a verb rather than divine, you know, divine gender.
And the way I love that.
Yeah, and the way you're speaking about tarot right now and the fact that you can't pin it down and you can't find the original, it's just like gender, you know, you can't find the original. And so you're divining
you
with
really
tarot.
Can't.
Yeah, yeah. So you divine with tarot and you divine with gender. And, you know, that's kind of a cool, I think, way, you know, to kind of think about it. In your chapter in the book, Between Naming and the Unknown, you say something very provocative that I wanted to kind of touch on. You ask the question, am I a man? Am I a woman? Both. Let us wait before we answer. Answers tend to end stories, which also kind of ties back to that penning of the butterfly that you spoke about. How do you sit with that question now for yourself that you ask in this book?
Well, I think that if we think of a normal life, we transition through many, many different identities. You know, we're students, sometimes we're mothers, we're people who menstruate, we're people who are menopausal, we are people who are sick, we are able-bodied, and that is inherent in life. And that if you picked one of those and then stayed with it your whole life, nothing would ever happen. That it's the ability to let go of an identity and to jump into another one that keeps your life, the narrative propulsion of your life happening. And I think for me, when I began to say, like, what is femininity? Like, I don't feel feminine in the way that the culture, you know, tells me I should be. I immediately thought, oh, then I have to be a man, or like, I have to be trans, I have to be something else. And I think instead I was like, oh, that's actually just re-articulating the same kind of structure, which is that I have to make a choice, vote for it, put my money behind it, and then commit to it my whole life. Mm-hmm. And the more interesting place to inhabit is saying, I get to be different every day. I get to change and to let this be indeterminate and to stay in that, you know, when electrons hop between orbits, we can't tell it where they are. That, you know, life happens through the vehicle of uncertainty. And that's where the most interesting movement happens, like metabolically, physically, also philosophically. And so I've been trying to like let myself off the hook when it comes to saying what I am or what other people are. And in fact, the biggest violence is saying that someone is something, saying, I understand you, there's a name for you, and you have to be committed to that performance. Mm. I love it when people interrupt my idea of their identity. And I think that we should be all helping each other do that all the time.
Mm-hmm. This ties into my next question, which I genuinely want you to help me with, because you know that I have struggled with this, and it's really for exactly the reason you're saying. So I am someone that really, honestly, to be totally honest, struggles with how to apply mythology to my life as someone that does feel not represented in a lot of those stories, at least the way that they've tended to get, you know, told. And I do understand the idea that we can shift them and that we can keep them alive. I mean, that's what we do with tarot too. You know, we keep the tarot alive through changing the way we talk about it. But I have the same problem in a lot of ways with tarot. And sometimes I feel that the lack of representation that I see in the stories of tarot or of mythology, when someone tells me to just kind of change it, it feels too simplistic, or like they're overlooking the difficulty of really not being represented or, you know, seen there. So what I'm trying to say is, like, you know, we did talk about this the last time you were on the show, about anthropomorphizing nature and the way that when people talk about like gods, the way that those are seen as humans. And something that just continues to really press on me as I study astrology — I was telling you I'm studying astrology right now — I find myself not even wanting to call the planets by pronouns. Like, I really want to just call them, I guess, it, for lack of a better word. And that's not because I'm trying to distance myself from it. It's actually because I'm trying to keep it bigger and more possible, you know, which I think is something that you really call for a lot in your work, is a grandness of possibility. So how do we find that in mythology? I struggle to not find reduction in mythology rather than expansion. And I would really love for you to kind of help me with that.
I think the issue is 99% of human history was oral, and it was adaptive. And you know, all of that partnership, nature reverent, wild, fertile knowledge has been subsumed under a very short time period of chirographic textual culture. So most myth that we have today is from a very narrow slice of, you know, imperial human culture. And so it doesn't surprise me that those myths from this very narrow slice of time that have become somehow lionized as representative of all mythology are not nourishing to you, not nourishing to me either. And the truth is that we have to kind of look under the hood and see what, you know, a lot of these mythologies came in and co-opted older, healthier oral modes and then rewrote them. And so one of the things I like to do is to like look at the story of, you know, Theseus killing the Minotaur and realize it's a bad rewrite of something that never got written down, but was much healthier, with a theriomorphic bull god who was associated with dances that honored the rising of constellations and the making of honey mead and of, you know, partnership culture. But that doesn't exist in a written text. You know, we have become so monomaniacal about stabilized knowledge as being written down, as you know, that you can prove that it exists. But the truth is, most of the knowledge that we've accumulated that kept us alive and kept us in sustainable relationship with landscapes never got written down. And so for me, the way into that is, you know, there's always pain because we can't access it. And colonialism has come in and killed the whole populations that held those stories in their body, and they're gone. But we can also look at the remnants and peer back through the mist. And one way that I like to do that is by contextualizing a deep time. And so I think that myth leaks well past the human, and that thinking that myth is a human enterprise is inherently violent, because the truth is that we're hardly even human. We're on the road to becoming something, and we were something else, you know, relatively recently when you know, plugged into the deep time history of the globe. And our bodies are made of, you know, bacteria that chose to forego their solitary shapes and merge, and then merge into multicellularity. I mean, that to me is a myth that's more helpful for me, which is that well beyond gender, well beyond dominator paradigms, well beyond heroes and individuals. What is it like for two beings to decide to give up their forms and half digest each other and make something entirely new? And for me, microbiology has opened up a whole world of mysticism that I don't feel like I get inside of anthropocentric textual myths.
So when you're like examining a myth, or if you were giving advice to someone who wanted to work with mythology, you know, how does one go about making sure that they are not just reinforcing things that are, you know, because that's another piece of it, I think, is, you know, for instance, in this astrology class, we have just moved into Venus and Mars. And the way we've been doing it on Slack is that each planet has had its own Slack channel. But interestingly, someone said, let's put Venus and Mars together in a Slack channel, because I think you can't separate them. And a few of us were immediately like, no, like, please do not, you know, have this heteronormative view of these planets. It's hard enough to resist that as it is. So, you know, what advice would you give to someone if they're looking to use mythology for their life? How do we keep resisting those same systems being just replicated, you know, through those stories?
You know, it's interesting, because I think that I've been a little inappropriately connected with myth as being some kind of like Platonic abstract ideal. And the truth is that I don't think anyone needs to study myth, especially not the myths of cultures that have nothing to do with where they live. Mm-hmm. And I'm interested in mythology as being a way of carrying on a dialogue with a place where you live. You know, myth as being a narrative where you can nest, where you can plant the seeds of certain kinds of ecological wisdom that then stays alive in relational telling, and stays alive because narratives are oftentimes easier to remember and retell than lists. You know, myth honestly is just a tool to carry, it's a ship to carry ecological knowledge. And so I don't want anyone to go read the Greek myths. I studied them because I'm interested in them, but that doesn't mean anyone else should study them. Mm-hmm. I think the kind of mythology I'm interested in inviting people into is the type that arrives from the place where you live. And you don't do that by studying, by entering into academia, by reading texts. You do that by sitting somewhere and noticing how your body is an instrument that's being played by the wind, by pheromones, by smells, how it notices certain birds. And how when you keep going to that spot repeatedly for a long time, suddenly you're aware of shifts, that the seasons are happening in a different way, that a tree isn't blooming. Why is it not blooming? It bloomed this time last year. And then all of a sudden you're actually getting real wisdom, real practical wisdom. And you say, how could I nest this in a story? How could I keep this knowledge alive? That's the kind of myth making that I'm interested in.
And you tell it, right? And you live it. I mean, I think that what you said earlier, it makes me think of when I had Lee Clapp on from Liminal Sight, who's a deaf tarot reader, and the suppression of the written word, I guess, which you were pointing out, you know, and you're saying, you know, that you tell it, you live it. And it reminds me of something in the book. I'm going to kind of skip to a section I was going to talk about a little later, where you're talking about Orpheus. And you talk about praying as Orpheus rather than praying to Orpheus. And that kind of reminds me that you're living as myth. You're not telling myth, or you're not reading myth or writing myth down. You're like living myth, you know?
Yeah. And I mean, it's all about that relationality, that self is only self through other. Cells are only cells by taking in other material, other cells, and then expelling them. That, you know, we're all part of a food web where one being's waste is another being's food, that we're all woven together by our appetites. And I think the same is true of storytelling. Storytelling is a way of making certain information digestible, keeping it moving, keeping knowledge moving. And so it's very, and honestly, it happened for so long through our bodies. It was not at all abstract. It happened through your actual breath that you were sucking in from an actual place, exchanging with an audience, that you were reacting to an audience, that it was happening in the interstitial space between you and other people.
Let's speak a little bit now about the Hanged Man as the Rooted One, which is one of your chapter titles. You talk in this a lot about the sort of the here-ness in which we can locate ourselves in our stories, like we're speaking about, in our knowledge and our spiritualities. And you write, quote, tarot for me is only useful as a tool insofar as it relates to my body and the landscape. So will you kind of expand on that? I think this is a really beautiful, useful, earthy, tangible way to think about the Hanged One. So I'd love to hear you talk about that.
So I'll actually share a practice I did with tarot. When I first started using tarot, it was the Rider-Waite because it was the deck that I had been given right before quarantine. And it's not the deck I wanted or chose. I'd had other decks in the past, but like the one I landed with was the Rider-Waite. And it was like so antithetical to my being. So it was like the wrong, it really made me angry. Like a lot of the cards made me angry. And yet they were what I had. Mm-hmm. And as I began to work with them, I thought, okay, this is not going to be helpful if it's just creating a whole other level of abstraction in my life. Mm-hmm. If I pull these cards and I think of something abstract, it's not helping me reach into my body, reach into my web of relations. It's not helping me actually live my life. So what I did is I actually physically planted each card in a specific place. So it became a mnemonic device of a place in my valley. So I planted the deck like a seeds. So then when I had another deck and I pulled the 10 of cups, the 10 of cups wasn't representing an emotional state or a theory or an archetype. It was evoking a place, a holobiont, an assemblage of beings. And so it was like had a root system that tied me to an actual place. And it was my way of like creating a holograph of my valley. So that, you know, when I was taking out my tarot deck, I wasn't taking out a bunch of archetypes or a bunch of cards. I was taking out a bunch of places and relationships. And so I think that when we have tarot decks, when we have stories, we have to find a way of connecting them into the place where we actually exist so that they help us not lift off into the world of abstract human concepts, but root into that multi-species polytemporal culpability with all of the beings that we actually share breath with.
Yeah. How do you feel now about tarot in terms of place-basedness with meaning, you know, with interpretation, you know, that Rider-Waite deck came from a certain time and place, but even further than that, you know, those came from other places. And yet those meanings have kind of kept being regurgitated and kept moving, you know, forward. So I'm always in this place of back and forthness with whether we should be honoring that history, whether, you know, how much of an importance should we place on that versus how much should we be really looking right now, which I do think is so, so important. I mean, and you know, I'm always talking about, can we please release Rider-Waite Smith and just thank it for what it did and just move forward, you know, but how do you sit with that?
Well, I think that all life is syncretic. So syncretism is an anthropological term where two religions meet each other and then blend and become something else. And oftentimes this is a colonial enterprise that's conscious, where one religion or belief system is consciously dominated and subsumed. But oftentimes most religions are syncretic. There are different cultures meeting each other that are pushed around by climatological changes. You know, human beings were peripatetic. They were nomadic. We moved. You know, even trees, species are constantly migrating. Like the idea of a climactic ecosystem is a very colonial idea. And the whole idea of invasive species is Eurocentric, because all species have been invasive at some point. So all modes, all epistemologies, all like ways of making meaning are syncretic at their origin. They're a combination of elements that we're not supposed to combine, but did. Mm-hmm. And I think that tarot can be a really interesting, it can be an ecotone, which is like, you know, the most biodiversity happens in the place where there's a sharp gradient between one ecosystem and another. Like suddenly you'll see explosions in the biodiversity of fish and birds in this place where, you know, sea becomes land or forest becomes meadow. It's that boundary that is not just a line, it's a thickness, it's an actual presence. It's like the fertile marginal, as you've written about. And so I'm really interested in the idea of the ecotone. And I think tarot is an interesting ecotone where we can see our prejudices. We can see the ways that we have ignored other beings. We can see history that's been occluded. We can see like these glimmers. And then we can also allow it to spark new fertile interpretations of experiences we're having now in our contemporary moment. So I think of the tarot as being an ecotone. An ecotone comes from the word oikos, household, and tonos for tension. So it's a place, it's a household where tensions are allowed to erupt and interact and to create something new.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about houses. Actually, I'm glad you brought that up, and homes. You talk in the book about our bodies as homes, and then you also explain that Dionysus was thought of as the foreigner, which really speaks to me and feels adjacent to the way I've been talking about the margin that you were just mentioning. And I know that you are someone that lives, you know, with chronic pain in your body and therefore in your home, if we're thinking of our bodies as our home. So, you know, what does it mean to live or even to be a home that is foreign in that way? And like, how do we reconcile that?
I think some of the most uncanny moments in a person's life, you know, we were thinking a lot about identity and self-conceptualization, which is some kind of effort that happens. You know, we think we assess how we feel, we move into a different definition of how we self-identify. And then there are the things that happen that we don't order off the menu. You wake up one day and you had an able body, and then suddenly you're severely disabled. There's a transition, there's no integration. It's something, you're foreign to yourself. You're a foreigner in your own body. And I think that wellness has become such a prison in our culture that any kind of deviation from that feels like a failure. And so what I've been trying to do when I talk to people with chronic illness and when I investigate it in my own body is to not problematize it anymore, to say, I am a foreigner in my own body most days. I don't really know what's happening. Sometimes there's a petty revolt in my pelvis, or, you know, there's a new mythology happening at the corner of my eye. And instead of contracting around that and seeing it as a deviation, I think of it as a becoming. I'm becoming something, and I have to be very curious about it. And I think Dionysus is an interesting character to associate with that experience, because Dionysus leaks well past our moral binaries of good and bad. Dionysus creates mayhem and generates connectivity and contact between beings, between social classes, between vegetation, between microbes that would never interact without that kind of anarchic influence. That he comes from the outside into the inside of the city, and then he draws people out of the city into the forest. So what he's doing is he's a breach, he's a break.
Yeah, I don't want to over poeticize or like pass over the difficulty, you know, of your lived experience when I ask this question, but I'm curious, you know, I loved how you were just speaking about that, the biodiversity that occurs in those meeting places. And so I'm wondering, in the meeting place of being a foreigner, you know, waking up and being a foreigner within your own body, what has emerged from that for you?
Well, I think I'll step into something else, which is, I've been thinking a lot about how disability is actually probably the way that biological novelty happens. So I was in a conversation with a famous scientist recently who's written about the patterns in nature and how they get they're more likely to happen the more they happen. So, you know, if a butterfly wing forms in this way, the more times that happens, the more likely it is to happen. And I said, well, how do you break those patterns? And he said, it's when there's a block, when something can't happen, when there's something in the way of that wing forming, that's when novelty finally breaks patterns. So patterns can be a good thing. You know, I look like generally what I looked like a week ago because there's a pattern to me. You know, I'm a doorway for matter and I could look like anything, but there's some kind of pattern to me that stabilizes. But then there's the patterns that are, you know, dominator culture is a pattern it becomes more and more stable the more it happens. And so I think of disability being this moment when there's a block and something new comes into shape. You know, there's a lack in you that draws in relationality, that to be correct is to be isolated. To be totally self-sufficient and well is to not need to have relationships and to not risk being changed and to be part of the stabilization of a pattern that might not be healthy. And so I think disability is the glitch that draws in healthier forms, ultimately, that it looks like dishealth, but actually what it is it's an experiment in a new pattern.
If you enjoy hearing conversations like this one, please consider supporting In Search of Tarot by becoming a member of our Patreon community. There you'll receive weekly mystic missives discussing any number of philosophical, tarological concepts, along with discounts to upcoming classes and workshops, and invitations to attend our monthly tarot hangs on Zoom. The financial support we receive through Patreon is the only way that we're able to pay our incredible guests who join us week after week to share their knowledge and life stories with all of you. We are so appreciative of our existing patrons' generous support, and we invite you to join them at patreon.com/insearchoftarot. So I want to talk about the chapter on the Minotaur, which you mentioned a moment ago. And you pose in that chapter the question, who is the monster of today's legends? And I'm going to again turn your own question back on you. What do you think, you know, who is the monster of today's legends?
This fits really well, because actually this is, I was thinking about this question, which is, I think the monster of today is the glitch, is the person with the genetic illness, the person with trauma, the person who won't heal, who won't conform to a normative well body, and the neurodivergent person. And that even when we self-identify with these categories, we do it to the point where we're like, now I can better adapt. Now I can do the correct treatment. And I think the monster of today is the person who refuses to heal. The person who says, I will not be cured. I will not let this become a problem. I will live with this and let it hobble me into holiness. I will stumble forward instead of trying to stand up straight. And I think that if you actually look, I was talking to someone who studies physiology. We're not built to be well. We're built to move forward and to keep surviving. That to stop moving is to risk being eaten by something and die. So the ways that our body incorrectly create survival mechanisms to keep us moving are correct, actually. The ways that we deform ourselves to keep moving are actually our superpowers. And so I think the monster of today is the person who says, I don't want therapy. I don't want trauma therapy. I don't want to complete this. I don't want to integrate this. I want to let myself grow around it and encompass it and become something monstrous.
Wow. I don't have anything to say about that, but I feel like I just need a moment to like take that in, because I think that is really true and really healing and a really great perspective amidst in a culture that does really prioritize like getting better or healing. I mean, like how often we talk about healing.
Performing it, completing it. Like I think it's amazing to get pain relief and to find ways that make your body more livable and pleasurable. But there's a great, as someone who has an incurable illness, I feel like I'm always failing. Like I because I can't perform the narrative arc of having gotten better, I'm exiled from the narrative.
Yeah. And I mean, it makes me think just of the lived experience that is true for all of us, that even when we do heal, we then, you know, it's always an up and down. I mean, it's always a wave, you know, and you're never just, I think about that actually a lot as a Libra. That's like how I've gotten to know my Libra sun, is that it's not that stasis would be death, you know, that like it's always fluctuating. So, you know, even if we heal, we then unheal. And what if we just looked at that as the way it is? I mean, the way it's meant to be, the way we were designed.
Exactly. I have a Libra moon and I really identify with it. And I think that, you know, balance only exists for a second. We're always in movement, in and out of balance. And it's that movement that creates the velocity of narrative. You know, to stay still is to be dead. To stay balanced is to be dead. That it's these moments of imbalance where we realize what we need to keep moving.
Right. So let's move now to a chapter on Joseph. In which you talk about how plants use us to dream, which I really loved. I had a dream guest on last season and really loved kind of going to that realm. I haven't really played with dream work much in my life, but I really enjoy thinking about it. So you write, quote, patriarchy associates dreaming with fiction. Dreaming can't be quantified or measured with an apparatus, but dream incubation was once considered cutting edge technology. So I'm wondering what your thoughts are on that and what you imagine that it might look like, or how it might change our world if we did treat our dreams in a bit more of a non-fictional kind of way.
Well, I think that we just have such a narrow idea of the ways in which we can know. And for most of human history, we've known that there are many different epistemologies, and most of them are embodied. Most of them come through our sensory apparatus. And one of the ways that we receive information is through our dreams. And from, yeah, so across cultures and across continents, people have known that dreams bring certain types of information to you, be they internal, be they relational, be they spiritual. You know, it's a way of making your life into poetry. Mm-hmm. And it was a way of receiving healing information all across the Mediterranean basin for thousands of years. You would go to places to receive the dream of a place. Also, dreams were not seen as individual possessions. They were seen as the emanation of a place using your body as an instrument. Mm-hmm. And I also think of that as being interesting. The Munsee Lenape and the people of the Hudson Valley who lived here thought of dream realization as being a community effort, and that when a person had a significant dream, the whole community had to come together to make it happen. Mm. And so dreams belong to a community. They were, you know, and I also, psychedelic culture has become so toxic and so conflated with this kind of hyper individuality of capitalism and wellness. But the truth is that in a lot of plant medicine cultures before colonialism, only one person would do the plant experience and then give that information to the whole community. That it was not about an individual healing or an individual dream. It was about a community effort to receive a certain type of knowledge, integrate it, and let it teach them better how to tend to a specific place.
Yeah, that's so hard for us, right? Or at least for myself, I'll say, like, the individualism is just so tied into white Americanness, I guess, you know. And I've been visited by death a lot. I dreamed about the death card not long ago, which I never dream about tarot cards, speaking of dreams. Huh. And, you know, it freaked me out, to be honest, because even though we all know the nice spin on death, it's still a little, you know, it's like, of all the cards to dream about, maybe that's not the one you're most happy to see. But it's gone through, like, many mutations of meaning, which has been very cool. And yesterday I was listening to a podcast and he was talking about, the way that the idea of death changes when we don't fear a loss of, like, the individual as much, you know, that other societies have not looked at the individual in that way. And that's part of what adds so much fear to dying is, like, I'm going to lose this highly unique, one of a kind thing that will never be again. You know, I don't know if that brings anything to mind for you, but it's been on my mind.
Absolutely. I think that death is the moment when life overflows its cup. It's when life gets too big for one, for oneself. You know, I sat with a dying deer once and then watched after it had died as it decayed. And I saw how one deer became millions of microbes and beetles and maggots and beings, and thought that we have lost this understanding that death is the ferment of life. You know, you have to make yourself edible. That we have to keep eating to stay alive. And ultimately we have to be eaten in order to be reintegrated back into other bodies. And that there's something quite beautiful about that, that maybe parts of me will be part of a hummingbird heart, or will be part of a lizard, or will be threaded into the soil. And that our idea of consciousness is so conflated with the brain. But the truth is that, you know, we think with places, our cognition is really embodied and distributed through our whole body, and then through our whole web of kin. And so we would have to understand that when we die, we're becoming edible, we're going out into that whole mycelial network of kin and feeding ourselves to them.
Yeah, it reminded me about, as I was talking about astrology yesterday, I was trying to get to know Venus a little better on Venus Day, you know, on Friday. And I was doing a meditation, kind of how I usually approach getting to know the planets. But Venus told me, or I learned, you know, to start touching myself. And what I got from it was, that is Venus. Like, you can't think me, you know, you can't think Venus. You have to touch, and that touch is the thinking, you know, like, which is, that's very hard to, you know, say in words, but that is the thought. And it reminded me of, you've shared before about spiders thinking with their webs. And also the margin, I also thought about this a lot at my wedding, that place of beginning, you know, of just when you're born and just after you die, that's the same place, you know, and that is the margin, you know, that the end and the beginning are both so important and fragile. I told you before we hopped on that I've also been feeling very protective of my beginner mind, and because anything can happen is very true, but also is a warning in a way, like any, you know, so it's like anything could happen. You could go anywhere. So choose wisely, you know, or, you know, there's a great possibility and great risk there, you know?
Yeah. I think of my favorite is hermit crabs, that they, you know, they don't produce their shells, they steal them. And, or no, they don't steal them, but they inherit the shells produced by other snails and beings, and they outgrow them. And when they outgrow them, they usually find another shell that's not the right size. But what they do is they exit the too small shell and stay next to the too big shell and wait outside as like this little fleshy being, unprotected, vulnerable being. And they wait for other hermit crabs to come. And then they form something called a vacancy chain, and they all exchange, so they all get the right size shell. But there's this moment of extraordinary vulnerability that can be hours or days long, where you're outside of your shell and the next shell has not arrived. And I think that those we need to help each other. And the truth is, no one gets to the next story on their own. You need a vacancy chain. And the vacancy chain means that the beings have to leave their stories. They have to enter that liminal realm. They have to let something die so that something new can begin. But to know that it's not an easy transition. There is a moment of profound, profound vulnerability outside of your shell.
This feeds into my next question for you. Something that I've heard you say a lot as I've known you is, I'm not throwing it out, I'm throwing it in. Yeah. You know, you talk about composting a lot, you use that as a metaphor, and you visualize this idea of melding ideas and information and making something, you know, brand new. So what I want to ask you about with that is, because I was thinking about this, you know, I think that's very true. And I believe that you, of all people, actually do that. But I kind of feel like sometimes when I hear that thought expressed, I find myself wondering, okay, but when is the moment when it actually does become the new thing, you know, versus when are you just resisting throwing something out that really does need to be thrown out, that really is outdated, you know, or that needs to transform. And I think about that a lot in terms of mythology as well, you know, as we're talking about myths kind of being misapplied or poorly applied. So I don't know. Do you have thoughts on that for me?
Yeah. So you can't throw anything out. And I think that cities, our culture is built on the idea that you can ship your waste somewhere else and it will disappear. Mm. So there's no throwing out. When you throw something out, what you're saying is, I want someone else to digest my shit. So throwing it in is taking responsibility for your shit. Mm-hmm. It's not saying that I accept this. It's saying I don't want to give this to someone else to have to digest who didn't create it in the first place. So throwing it in is about making it rot. Like when I take patriarchal capitalism, I'm not saying you get to just hang out here. I'm saying I want to combine you with so much water, with so many microbes, with so much grossness that you start to break down. Mm-hmm. And inclusion is the first step in decay. And when you throw something out and you don't take responsibility for it, you know, a great example is during the Carboniferous period, woody plants first arrived, but white rot hadn't evolved yet. So all of this dead woody matter died and then didn't decay. It didn't go make soil, it didn't make room, and it began to compact and swamp life. It actually created a climatological event whereby the temperature dropped and radically dropped, and so many beings died. It's that compacted, undigested matter that is now the fossil fuels fueling climate change today. So that's a great actual biological example of what happens when we pretend like we don't have to deal with something and don't have to break it down. And so I think for me, throwing it in is not about acceptance. It's about an active, culpable decay process. Can I begin to, like an oyster mushroom, attune my appetite to radiation? Can I begin to learn how to eat things and digest them and transform them instead of giving them to someone else to poison them?
That is a really good clarification on that. And I appreciate that. Thank you. So my last question for you today is something that I've been asking everyone, but I'm going to put a spin on it for you. Okay. So, you know, I've been asking, what are you in search of? But I wondered if there is a way that you might answer that with a myth, whether that is an existing myth that comes to mind for you when we think of searching for something, or a myth of your own creation, or, you know, a melding and composting of all of that. So what have you got for us on that?
So I thought about this a lot. And then I decided that I love when I break the rules. And so I'm going to break the rule and say that the story that I've been working with, the myth I've been working with, is the film Groundhog Day, starring Bill Murray.
Amazing.
And that really, which is, you know, in the movie, if you haven't seen it, he is this cranky, nasty, not very nice guy who gets stranded in this hotel on Groundhog Day that he hates. And he hates all the small town parochial stuff. He hates everyone there. And he gets stuck looping on that day millions of times. He has to live it over and over and over again. And I feel like it's an incredible lesson in getting, like, confronting yourself and your bullshit, which is like, you know, the first 100 days he pretends he's a god, he can do anything. Then he becomes suicidal. He goes through all of these different contractions of self. You know, Gertrude Stein says there's no such thing as a repetition, only insistence. That, you know, every time something happens that feels the same, it's showing you something different. And I got stranded in this town alone at the start of quarantine, and my days took on an incredibly redundant quality, that there was an iterative quality to my life that began to feel like imprisonment. And yet suddenly I realized I was being shown, you know, at the end, the best part about the film, and I will spoil it, so turn it off if you don't want it spoiled, is at the very end, when the day finally stops repeating, he gets the girl and he enters into life. He's come to this place where he knows every person. He can help everyone during that day. Like, his life has become not about him and his own struggle, but about doing the day correctly, even if it's already happened. And when he finally enters the next day, he says, "Let's live here." He doesn't want to leave. And I think that the myth I've been living is this contraction around redundancy and repetition, and feeling like I'm not progressing. I'm not moving into the phase that I want to move into. I'm not, the right partner hasn't arrived. I'm not having a child. I'm not buying my own home. You know, I'm in a place that I didn't think I would be for so long, but instead I feel like I've been forced to look at how the microcosm of the whole world is right here in front of me. And the intimate relationships I've created with these beings here are representative of the whole world. Like, this is where I'm supposed to be. This is where all my magic is. I don't need to outsource it. I don't need to go anywhere else. This is the place I've been supposed to land and to go very deep with.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Isn't it so hard to let the ego, to live with the ego? I mean, like, that's what it, that's what it makes me think of, because I know that feeling of, is it okay to be okay? You know, and how much should I be wanting from life? And I mean, it made me think about what you were talking about earlier with wellness culture and this idea of being healed. It's also that myth of forward motion or progression, yeah, or achievement, you know, but it's so hard because, like, there've been points in my life where, when I've been in my most meditative practices, my ego gets very scared. I almost feel like I'm on this cliff of, like, if I keep going forward into this, I will really let go. Like, I will really just be. And, like, that's wonderful and sounds great. But also I'm like, is that it? Is there more? I want to make use of this life? You know, I mean, how do you balance that? You know?
I don't know. I mean, the one thing I was thinking,
you can't answer that.
the thing that I've been realizing is when life is happening at a kind of at a nice clip, and life is easy and you can travel and there are many events and you're doing things, you kind of don't have to change because the world is changing for you. And you're allowed this superficial experience of evolution. But when the world is not changing and you have to meet yourself every day in front of the mirror, and in front of the same birds, the same ducks, the same place, suddenly the change has to become internal rather than externally sourced. Mm-hmm. And so I think that there's a way in which we avoid the ego when we're moving really fast through life. And then we have to, when we get really, really quiet and still, we can finally begin to do that work to untangle it. It's not about getting rid of it. It's about realizing that it's like a hat you're wearing.
What a dream, Sophie. I mean, like, honestly, I hope you know that I mean this, that I could talk to you forever. And I'm truly honored that you made time to come on. So tell everyone how they can find you. I'm sure everyone that's listening already follows you, but if they don't, how they can find you, how they can order the book, and how they can join you for this course.
Thanks, Nick. I also just want to reiterate that I feel like you're a person who can run as fast as me. You're as wild as me. Like, yeah. There are a lot of people who, like, I say things like, you know, gender is rhizomatic and non-human, and, you know, and they're like, whoa. And I feel like when I'm talking to you, I can finally, like, feel like I'm moving in the way that I want to move. So thank you.
I'm so glad. Yeah.
And I really, really love and value your work. So I just want to underline that. You can find me on Substack, sophiestrand.substack.com. I post a lot of free content. It's important to me to keep ideas moving, to complicate ideas of individual authorship. If you want to support me, know that it's, you know, going towards my actual healthcare, but don't feel like you have to. I'm doing this rewilding mythology course with Advaya that will feature all of my favorite thinkers, be they fermenters or scientists or mythologists or tarot readers, many different perspectives. That's the most important thing. It's a biodiversity of perspectives. So you can sign up anytime during the course up until December 19th, and you'll be able to access past modules, an online community. And my book comes out November 22nd, The Flowering Wand. And it is very goofy and sincere. So I welcome you into that very goofy party.
All right, Sophie, thank you so much for today. Nick.
In Search of Tarot is independently written, recorded, edited, and transcribed by Nick Kepley and Angie Miller. You can follow Angie on Instagram at birdgirl_, that's birdgerhl_, and you can follow me, Nick, on Instagram at In Search of Tarot. Have a question or a comment? Email us at isotpod@gmail.com. We also invite you to leave us a rating and review on Spotify or Apple Podcasts.